Hello and welcome to the Euractiv Agri-Food Podcast. I'm Natasha Foote.
And I'm Gerardo Fortuna.
And here's your weekly update on all things agriculture and food in the EU from Euractiv's Agri-Food News Team.
So this week, we'll be talking about the Common Agricultural Policy.
A huge shock. That's going to be a huge shock to everyone after this last week, I'm sure.
Yeah, that there was, as you said, there was a provisional agreement on the Common Agricultural Policy reform.
What are we going to do with ourselves, Gerardo?
That's a tricky question, actually.
It's actually, it's crazy because I've been following it for my entire time that I spent with Euractiv, but so have you, no? It's been like 3 years.
Yeah, three years. I actually covered even the proposal, the first proposal of the Common Agricultural Policy.
Does it make you feel a bit emotional?
No, because I mean, it's a never-ending topic, actually.
I know, of course, but like you saw it all the way through from its inception to its near conclusion. I just wonder,
yeah, no, I mean,
do you feel like you're losing a baby?
Yeah, from the emotional point of view, it's like I had the baby too. You know, I was in the room shaking hands with the Portuguese minister, and
shaking hands in COVID time.
Bumping
elbows.
That's an unfortunate analogy. Doing the elbow touch, whatever it is. because actually, yeah, I mean, we covered that a lot. We kind of become experts of this very technical stuff.
Obsessive, I would say.
Yeah. It's the end of a journey, but it's not really
the beginning of another one.
Yeah, the beginning of another one, because now there's the issue with the national plans. Actually, the commission recently, there was the Agri-Fish Council this week on Monday and Tuesday, the last one of the Portuguese presidency.
Yeah, we should probably give some background.
Yeah, and the commission was asked if it was possible, it would be possible to reject the national plan on the basis of the Green Deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what they reply, Natasha? Because you published an article on that.
Well, he replied that the only basis to reject, like outright reject a national strategic plan would be if it didn't comply legally on some kind of legal grounds, mm-hmm. Then said, and obviously the Green Deal isn't legal. And so he basically said, you know, he doesn't imagine or foresee any scenario where they would outright reject a strategic plan based on the Green Deal.
And but instead, even in general.
Well, actually, even in general, yeah. But instead, he would, they would be engaging in constant dialogue with member states to try and improve the member states, national strategic plans. So yeah, quite interesting. I mean, kind of interesting statement, I would say, from the outset, looking in.
There were many topics actually in the agenda of the Agri-Fish Council. You can check on our website, euractiv.com, for the coverage. For instance, there was a proposal for a ban of fuel farming. The main point of the agenda was, of course, the endorsement of the agriculture minister of the Common Agricultural Policy deal, which was finally struck last Friday.
What a way to start the weekend that was.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, the entire episode will be a sort of cap special.
A recap on the cap.
Another one, because I mean, it's like
millions of them.
Yeah. And we're trying to bring you some detail, you know, lots of detail. But we're going to have a lot of guests with us, helping us, giving all the information of the most interesting aspect, because I mean, Common Agricultural Policy is huge, you know, it's tree regulation.
And we have to unpack the cap. That's a lot to unpack. There's a lot going on there.
So we kick off our episode today with actually a good friend of ours, who's also would you be offended if I call you a senior agriculture reporter?
Oh, Gerardo. I was going to say he's an old hat at this, you know, an expert.
An expert.
Oh my God, no, no. An expert, yeah. Okay. Yes, if you want, call me as you want. I mean,
oh no, you offended our guest, Gerardo. It's not very good podcast etiquette, I have to say.
No. No, no, no. It's others that have to say that. It's not me.
So today with us, we have Angelo Di Mambro, who's a reporter for agriculture reporter for Italian news agency ANSA, l'Informatore Agrario, an Italian specialized media on agriculture. Thanks for being with us, Angelo.
Thank you for calling me. Thank you.
And you can give us actually a bit of, not an overview, but I mean, considering that you covered also other common agricultural policy negotiations, like the previous one for the previous programming program. I would like to ask you, first of all, what's your take on the outcome of the negotiations, and if you can, you know, find some parallel on precedent negotiation that you covered in your experience.
The first thing that comes to my mind is that we have a CAP reform that is quite conservative in terms of policy tools. In the end, it's the same CAP of 20 years ago. Okay, we had adjustments, but in the end, we have direct payments per hectare. There are support to income, market measures, and rural development. This is something that we know, we have been knowing for 10 to 20 years. At the time, 20 years ago, it was a real revolution to have an income support. But now, I don't know. And these features, I mean, it's since 2018, since the presentation of the proposal of the CAP reform, the proposal on CAP reform has never been revolutionary on policy too.
It was done on purpose, yeah.
Yeah, it was a strange period. It was the end of Juncker commissioning. A question that I asked many times to then Commissioner Philogan, do you think that we'll get the result, the DCAP reform done in 1 year with the European election that happened in 2019? So it was basically a reform not on policy tools, but it was a reform on governance, on who decides what. It was basically transfer of powers and responsibilities from Brussels to member states. Then in 2020, the Green Deal arrived, and it happened something strange. The Commission asked the European Parliament and the Council to make the needed changes to align the CAP reform to the Green Deal. Instead of, I don't know, withdrawing the reform proposal and presenting another one aligned with its new political priority. I mean, the Green Deal was the political priority of the Commission.
They basically ask, fix the gap.
Make the best of a bad deal, basically.
It was quite unique in my experience. And since then, the debate focused on the environmental side of the policy, and the debate totally neglected the governance part. That was there. Because it's not for chance that the most controversial point in the negotiation that concluded last week was about embedding the green architecture in the national plans. It was where the two sides, the two main changes, the governance change and the greening of the policy, collided. Now we have the reform, and while I think that nuance of green, let's say, of the CAP performance, I mean, if it will deliver, it will largely depend on what member states will decide to implement on the ground. But the policy tools issue and tackling it is somehow essential for a CAP might be more up to date. Is a structure mainly designed in the late 1990s, still fit for purpose? More precisely, do the direct payments per hectare and the way they are distributed make sense as tools for farmers, and are they understandable by citizens?
That's the elephant in the room, basically, you know, that everything.
And I don't think that it will pass so long time before we start the discussion again. And I hope that the next time it will be the right one to start discussing these policy aspects that were somehow absent.
Tashi, remember you actually wrote an article on the future of the farming subsidies for the UK after Brexit, no?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They already asked this this question. So basically they want to focus more on rural development, you know.
Yeah, they basically want to do away more or less with direct payments and move towards, at least this is England, but they obviously got the devolved nations.
Sorry, England.
Yeah, yeah, be careful there. Yes.
indeed. Yeah.
Let's tread lightly there. No, they're actually talking about it all over the UK, but in England they've started actually trying to work towards, they've proposed to do away pretty much with, I think completely actually, with direct payments and move towards rural development, which is obviously, you know, something that's been spoken about before in the past. The UK was a proponent of it back in the glory days when we were in the EU. But yeah, I wonder maybe, Angelo, what your take is on that and whether you think that's maybe the future direction for the EU's cap as well in the future.
Usually the experts in the commission, they say, no, income support is still valid because it gives stability. We have the increasing risk of climate change. And this is a systemic risk. It's on income, is on for parasites and pests. We have also environmental issues that are not tackled in a sufficient way. In the old era, we were used to have a trade dispute that was starting from, I don't know, hormone beef and staying in the food sector. That was the hormone beef trade issue dispute between the EU and US. With the Russian embargo, and then also with the Trump administration measures, we have seen that food sector can be hit by restrictions to export, and so decreasing level of income from political reasons. I mean, that reasons that are nothing to do, that has nothing to do with the sector reason, with the economic reason. We have seen a kind of separation and a kind of very strong and harsh opposition between farmers and citizens, between farmers and environmentalists. But the link, the connection between farming and society, maybe is worth some resources more. Also from the EU, the base payment per hectare is shrinking. I mean, it's 25% of the direct payment will go to environmental, to eco schemes. This means that the basic payment, the basic support is shrinking. So it's already changing. The next reform we will discuss about policy, not about old stuff, really, because in some aspects, the debate resembled the eternal debate between the farmers, polluters, and urban dwellers, environmentalists. And this is really something that I did not appreciate. I mean, it's old story. The rural areas strategy that was presented today is worth of more resources, more attention. Because the development is not something that happens in a sector. Development is something that happens in a place.
And as we just said, green architecture was one of the main issues on the table of negotiators. Actually, it was we can say one of the points was basically the one that led to a failure in talks in May. You remember?
Mm-hmm. I do indeed. The collapse. Such a sad moment where we realized our final cap down hashtag was premature.
We were almost there. We were almost there, ready for becoming legendary.
Really?
More than what we already are.
Please, we're already there.
Yeah. So you remember actually the talks collapsed on this proposal from the council related to the eco schemes.
Yes, so indeed.
Eco schemes are basically the percentage of common agricultural policy direct payments earmarked for environmental friendly agricultural practices. So basically the green portion of the first pillar. And the issue was basically where to set the bar. You remember in the mandate that the European Parliament gave to the negotiator, the Parliament negotiators, the bar was set at 30%. So 30% of the direct payment should have been directed to green measures. The council wanted 20. And we knew.
We all saw where this was going.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a mathematician to figure this out, do you?
And in the end, they reach a compromise on 25%.
No.
Yeah. But for the whole period. But the issue was about the floor mechanism. This floor mechanism.
Some sneaky tactics that was going on here.
Yeah, indeed. So it's basically a floor that allows the spending of unused funds between, you know, the 20 and 25%. So the floor was set at 20 in the end. And so these unused funds between 20 and 25, you know, could be considered as more flexible. Mm-hmm. But of course, in order to be flexible, they need to be compensated by the end of the programming period through some kind of compensation mechanisms. So it's a bit complex, but originally the floor was set at 18%, and this 18% floor baseline, let's say, led to the failure of talks. So in the end, they found this compromise.
You just floored me with your knowledge there.
We can say that actually, who won on this battle, basically?
You've got the 25% ring fencing. So that was the, you know, what they both were happy with. But then there was this kind of learning period that was introduced with the 20% floor, which is only 2% more than what the council proposed.
The Parliament wanted something like 22 or 23%.
Yeah. So it's not a clear winner in this one, I would say.
I wouldn't say it's a draw, but it's more like...
It's not a draw, I would say. It's definitely leaning towards...
The council.
The council.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, no one would actually have imagined that the Parliament would have got the 30% in the end. So it's still...
Yeah, it was an opening kind of offer, wasn't it?
Yeah, indeed. And also the other ring fencing that was decided during the negotiations was the one related to the rural development. So basically the green spending in the second pillar.
This one's got a clear winner. This one. There is absolutely no debating who came out on top here, is there?
Yeah, and the council, of course, because I mean...
The council. The council wanted, for background, at least 35% ring fencing. The Parliament wanted at least 37%. And where did we end up? I mean, we should have ended up at 36. What happened here?
They weren't convincing enough, let's say.
Well, clearly. I mean, spoiler alert, they ended up on 35%. So there we go. It's the council.
The Parliament, I mean, the main argument of the Parliament is that the 37.5% was the percentage in the transitional period. So the one that actually was embedded in the Next Generation EU.
Yeah.
So basically, they didn't want any, let's say, step back to the Next Generation position. But in the end, it didn't work.
This is one of the moments that you think you have to remind yourself and everyone listening, I suppose. You know, when we talk about these 1% differences, I was saying, you know, it should have been 36%. And it sounds like nothing, but when it's such a monumentally huge policy with such a big pot of money, it's actually, you know, it's a big difference.
It's true. I mean, we're talking about a package of 340 billion.
Yeah, a third of the
entire EU budget.
Yeah.
When we're talking about, as you say, when we talk about...
talk about 1%, sounds like nothing, doesn't it? But...
It's quite a lot. And another aspect of this green architecture was one of the main requests of the European Parliament. We remember it was embedded in the mandate voted by the plenary in October. And it was the alignment of the Common Agricultural Policy with the Green Deal. Mm-hmm. Initially, this was basically an attempt to put the targets, you know, the many targets that are included in the Farm to Fork strategy, like
biodiversity strategy.
And the biodiversity strategy too, like the pesticide reduction, the organic 25% of organic farmed organically in Europe by, I don't remember the year, but anyway, all the targets set in the Farm to Fork strategy and the biodiversity strategy, recognizing some article of the Common Agricultural Policy. In the end, it didn't go like this because they got this recognition, but in a recital, which is at the very beginning of the regulation, but it's not a proper article. You know, when you
it's basically a weaker commitment.
Yeah, weaker commitment, and it's basically, you know, after it's the part with the letters. You know, point A, point B. For instance, you cannot actually go to the European Court of Justice to basically
uphold them.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Mm. As you said, it's weaker. But still, it's
still a mention. They managed to sneak a mention in there, which was the aim, wasn't it? I mean, just not a super strong mention. So if you had to talk about winners or losers here, I mean, where would you?
It's tough because, as you said before, Farm to Fork strategy is a vision, no?
Yeah.
It includes, of course, some revision of legislation, like the pesticide reduction is an actual revision of the SUD directive, the Sustainable Use of Pesticide Directive. But still, I mean, it's something that will come in 2 or 3 years, while the Common Agricultural Policy will enter into force in 2023.
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand the legal basis of the Council opposition. Of course, we're talking about a political objective. So lawmakers could have put a political objective in a law if they wanted, but
you're saying they didn't want to.
it would have been ambitious, very ambitious. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I mean, it was a result because I mean, it wasn't, of course, included in. We need to remind that the Green Deal came after the initial proposal of the Commission on Common Agricultural Policy.
And we actually spoke to the chair of the ENVI committee, so that's Pascal Canfin, to hear his take on the Green Deal alignment of the CAP reform.
The deal we found on the CAP will allow a much better alignment between agricultural policies and the Green Deal objectives and legislations. Why? For two reasons. The first reason is that we have a specific provision in an article plus in a recital that will make sure that the strategic national plans that are the heart of the CAP will be assessed by the Commission whether they are consistent with the Union's environmental and climate legislations. And if they are not consistent with the EU environmental legislations, then they will be not approved by the Commission. We moved the relationship between environmental policies and the CAP from past situation where the CAP had to contribute to, it's the legal wording of the previous, or let's say the current CAP, contributing to a wording which is consistent with. And of course, it's a massive change. It's a massive change because it's very easy to contribute to an environmental objective, even if we do not deliver on climate neutrality, you do not deliver on no biodiversity loss, and so on and so on. But being consistent with the Union's legislative objectives, regarding climate neutrality or regarding nature protection, restoration of lands, and so on and so on, that will be another story. So that's why that's the core of the change of the relationship between the Green Deal and the CAP. The second element is the eco-schemes, and the Parliament didn't fight for the highest possible number, because 27, 28, 30% of greenwashing, it's still greenwashing. What we fought for is a figure, let's say, in the middle of the situation between the parliament and the council, so around 25, but with robustness. And we have this robustness. We have the point system, meaning that you will not just make one eco-scheme and you get all the 25% of the Pillar 1 money. We have the robustness because the Commission will have a strong say in the list and the assessment of the robustness of the eco-schemes. And we have the robustness because we have the green channel. The green channel means that even if you do not spend the 25% on eco-schemes, let's say 22% because the farmers do not subscribe, I would say, the eco-schemes, then the remaining money has to be spent for green purposes. So extra bonuses for the farmers having eco-schemes, or more organic subsidies, whatever, in Pillar 2, whatever, but it's a green channel. So that's why we made sure that 25% of Pillar 1 is dedicated to green spending, which was definitely not the case before, as we all know, because no figure of that kind was existing. So if I take only these two elements, and there are many others, but only these two elements, which are, to my view, critical, that makes a big difference. That makes a big difference between the current CAP and the next CAP. Of course, everything is not perfect, and except that it's a compromise. And regarding my own objectives and the NV position, I had to compromise, obviously, otherwise there would be no CAP at all. But we secured these two key elements that will make a big difference between the current CAP and the next one. That's why I will be supportive of the compromise we found when we will have to vote on it in the parliament.
And another part, we're talking about this green architecture, another key aspect of this that's been raised a lot, especially by NGOs, is this issue of the GIACs. So the GIAC, it stands for Good Agricultural and Environmental Conditions, basically. And there's a number of these different GIACs that have been a bit of a sticking point, shall we say, in these negotiations. And actually, we got in touch with one of the NGOs that's very active on all things CAP and GIAC. And we spoke with Harriet Bradley from BirdLife about these GIACs, what they are and what happened and what this means for the future of agriculture.
So GIAC standards stands for Good Agricultural and Environmental Conditions in the CAP jargon. And these are essentially what you have to do if you want to get the main CAP subsidies. So the basic amount that you will get for each hectare of land that you have. They cover things like habitat for nature on farms, soil protection, crop rotation, and grassland protection. And they're important because they're the rules that everybody has to comply with if they want to get the bulk of the CAP subsidies that they're entitled to. So this is unlike other measures like eco schemes, which are voluntary to enter into. And so what this means is that they will impact practices on the largest area of land, and therefore what they require beneficiaries of CAP money to do will affect whether the CAP will keep subsidizing intensive or harmful practices like monoculture farming, or whether these will be restricted by the requirements of these GIACs. And actually, the major reason, one of the main reasons why we're so unhappy with the CAP deal is precisely because in the end, these standards will be very low, even lower than what the Commission was proposing. And many of the loopholes that are in the current CAP that allow the subsidies to keep going to intensive farming have just been put back in. So, for example, there's no requirement for all farms to have enough natural habitat to support wildlife. There's no requirement for meaningful crop rotation. Permanent grasslands are not adequately protected, so a proportion of these can continue to be ploughed up. And finally, the CAP subsidies will most likely be able to continue to go to farming on drained peatlands, which is a huge source of greenhouse gas emissions. However, member states do have to further define what the GIECs actually mean, and they can also propose additional GIEC standards if they wish. And obviously the risk is that they will try to use all the loopholes that they have been negotiating in the deal and to do the least possible under these standards. At the same time, they are going to be required to justify their choices of GIECs to the European Commission with respect to the CAP's environmental objectives and also environmental legislation. So if the European Commission is very strict with the member states at this stage, then there is obviously still some scope for improvement.
So you've spoken a lot about the environmental aspects of this CAP reform and the environmental conditionality, but there was another kind of conditionality that was introduced kind of late into the game, wasn't there, Gerardo?
Yeah, it was actually quite late in the game, as you said, because it wasn't included in the Commission's proposal.
Indeed.
In 2018, but actually was put on the table by the Parliament. It was included in an amendment that passed in the plenary last
October. What are we talking about here?
We're talking about the social dimension, or the social dimension of the Common Agricultural Policy, so the so-called social conditionality.
Yeah.
So basically linking the direct payment to the respect of the basic labor law when it comes to, for instance, a workforce on the farms.
Which is interesting because, as ministers pointed out repeatedly, this is quite far out of the remit of, you know, traditionally of the CAP.
Indeed.
I mean, it wasn't linked to any social elements.
That's why, for instance, some people are actually speaking of a third pillar of the CAP. You know, I mean, the first pillar is direct payment. This is kind of the butter and bread of the farming subsidies. And then there's the rural development. It was quite an innovation, came 10 years ago, but it's more about the potential that this inclusion of social conditionality could have in the Common Agricultural Policies to come, no?
It is a whole new kind of branch of it, isn't it? You know, a new kettle of fish, I would say.
Indeed.
So, you know that expression?
No, I like it. It's more common fisheries policy than common agricultural policy, but still, we're covering that too. So basically, it's not that much. Doesn't seem that much because, I mean, we're talking about the implementation phase of this social conditionality concept. To start on a voluntary basis in 2023 and becoming mandatory starting from 2025. Mm-hmm. But there's this 2-year rendezvous clause. That's the name.
Rendezvous clause.
Yeah. So basically the Commission is asked to monitor the impact of this mechanism on, of course, on worker conditions. But they have to come up with a study and, you know, potentially with a proposal to enlarge the scope of this social dimension, for instance, including the condition of migrant workers. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of potential.
Which is a huge issue in farming, migrant and seasonal workers, upholding their rights and figuring out who's doing what where.
Indeed.
And actually, to talk a little bit more about this, the social conditionality, we spoke with Enrico Somalia from EFAT. So that's the trade union that deals with agriculture. And they've been really active on this issue. And so he's here to explain. This is what he said about social conditionality.
The inclusion of social conditionality in the political deal on the common agricultural policy is certainly great news for millions of farm workers in Europe, and it is an important victory of the trade union movement and of many civil society organizations that have really supported this fight. farm workers are never featured in the common agricultural policy, despite the improvement of their living standard is actually of one of the CAP main objectives according to the treaties, and despite the fact that agriculture is one of the most challenging and precarious sectors of the economy, with high levels of undeclared work, poor health and safety standards, and deplorable housing conditions, particularly for migrant workers and for seasonal workers. So for the first time in history, we can definitely say that the EU institutions have agreed on a CAP reform that doesn't overlook this reality anymore and takes into account the conditions of millions of workers that really, thanks to their outstanding dedication, ensure that food is available on our table also throughout this disgraceful pandemic. The support of the European Parliament has been, of course, crucial throughout this process. We didn't manage to get everything we were demanding for as trade unions, but we are really confident in the fact that if well implemented, the social conditionality, as it has been agreed, can really become an effective tool to increase the labor standards in agriculture. We regret, of course, to see that because of the position of the Council, member states will be obliged to start social conditionality only from 2025. But it will be possible, of course, to start also from 2023. And we will be very active together with our affiliates to ensure that this is the case in each and every member state, because we believe that this is absolutely possible. We have to remain vigilant, of course, in the upcoming weeks and days, because important elements and key wording will still be discussed and agreed during technical meetings. And then, of course, we have to pay a lot of attention to what is happening then at national level. It's also important to remind that together with the inclusion of social conditionality, other social elements are now part of the deal. There is a new role for farm advisory services to provide information to farmers on working conditions. And member states will also have the opportunity to promote the improvement of working conditions also as part of their sectoral intervention. Finally, I must say that as EFAT, we also regret that it was not possible to achieve a more ambitious deal on the green architecture, because, I mean, the fight against climate change is vital for our planet and for future generations. But it's also very important to protect jobs and workers' rights. So a more positive outcome on the environmental dimension would have, of course, made our judgment even more positive. But we will certainly be extremely active to ensure that what has been achieved for the first time on social aspect represents really a right step towards a more socially just agricultural sector in Europe.
And there are also other interesting points that we can touch on in the next minutes. And of course, one of these, it's about the redistribution of the CAP spending, because there were some concerns in the past. So for instance, one of the main innovation is this mandatory redistributive payments of at least 10% of direct payments.
Yeah.
So it's a way to target the support. But, you know, when we're talking about targeting of support, there's also another huge elephant in the room, which is this internal convergence concept.
Yeah, this idea of internal convergence, I mean, it's a little bit complicated, but it's basically, I mean, convergence is this process of kind of redistributing, evening out the money, maybe across either member states, but also within member states. Because in some member states, you know, generally speaking, the older ones, some of them have this kind of historical hangover from previous caps, which mean that for various reasons, some farmers get more money per hectare than other farmers. And that's something that it's only really still an issue for certain member states, but where it is an issue, it's quite contentious. Lots of member states have actually already completed internal convergence, meaning basically it's completely evened out between farmers. But one member state where this has been an issue for a number of years is Ireland. They started the process of redistribution, but, you know, they're only at something like 65%, I think, off the top of my head. Basically, the parliament was pushing for all member states to have 100% internal convergence, for everyone to achieve that. And actually, what they ended up with at the end of the day was exactly what the council asked for, which was 85%. So all payments being at least 85% of the average unit amount. And as it was such an issue for Ireland, we actually spoke with Irish MEP Colm Markey to hear his take on the conclusions when it comes to internal convergence.
For Ireland, convergence has been one of the most controversial parts of CAP. I suppose for one thing, it set one farmer against the other. One farmer was set to gain at the other's expense, where traditionally productive agriculture was losing out to more extensive agriculture. One of the concerns is that those farmers in the productive sector, I suppose, had a whole industry behind them, whether it be processing in the beef sector or dairy. There was jobs and employment and a multiplier effect in the economy that was set to lose out. I suppose the reality with convergence is it's someone described it to me as a ball rolling down a hill. It had already started in 2013 and you weren't going to stop it at this stage. But the key thing is the rate of convergence and how quick it happened. If you were to go to 100% convergence at this stage, it would probably threaten the viability of some of those commercial farmers who, in a lot of cases, were of a significant scale and may employ staff on their farms and, as I say, have a multiplier effect in the economy. And if you're to threaten those, you threaten not only their own situation, but the situation of, let's say, employees and the industry as a whole. So it was vital that we didn't overly impact on those farms and reduce their competitiveness. And I suppose the fact that it was an 85% convergence took account of that. I think 100% convergence would really have challenged those farmers. And the fact that we've gone with 85, it's probably a fair compromise. Like, it was at 60% before this. To go to 85% is probably more or less a halfway step to complete convergence. And I'd expect that probably to be on the agenda for the next CAP reform. But at 85%, it's given those farmers a chance. It's allowing the other farmers, the more extensive farmers, it's helping them, if you like, in terms of viability. And I think as a reasonable compromise, it's something that I think is probably a fair landing position to finish up at. The second key area is probably the whole area of the eco-schemes. This is one that obviously everybody is watching, and I suppose the whole trick here is going to be part of the national strategic plans to ensure that the eco-schemes are effective, but practical as well, that are implementable at farm level. And I think that's the big challenge. But I think there probably is enough scope, and certainly from an Irish perspective, the Irish Department of Agriculture have put forward a number of schemes that would be potential eco-schemes that they hope to include in their strategic plan. And I think they should be workable. And once the schemes are implementable and practical, I think farmers will engage with them quite effectively.
We can basically have an eternal podcast.
We could be here for hours.
For hours.
Literally hours. All the ins and outs of all the drama of the whole CAP. I mean, that would be a saga.
Yes, indeed. Mm. So what we can point out ultimately is that, for instance, this couple payment support that was set in the end at 30% of the direct payment, with an addition of 2% per proteic crops, which seems super, super technical, but actually it was one of the main controversial issues, because we know that there are some countries that are not super in favor of this support linked to the production. Mm-hmm. So they had to negotiate a bit on this. And the other aspect that we like to highlight is the final decision to increase the young farmer support.
After all, obviously, this is looking to the future, for the next 7 years. So we're talking about the new farmers coming through. I mean, there's a massive focus on young farmers, new farmers.
Indeed.
Generational renewal. How many ways can I find to say that?
Yeah, no, indeed. It's probably the problem, let's say. There was this week the launch of the new vision of the EU for rural areas, which is also linked to the problem of the population of rural areas, of course, caused by the fact that young people are not happy with being farmers, you know, which sounds crazy for you, for instance.
It doesn't sound that crazy, actually. I mean, it's a pretty thankless. I mean, in some ways, it's such a fulfilling. Oh, you're going to set me off now into my spiel. But in some ways, it's so fulfilling, and in other ways, it's so thankless, and so it's not such a difficult. I mean, all my experiences working on different farms, it's so challenging. You know, you can kind of see why it's maybe not super appealing to young people in some respects. In other respects, being close to nature, being outside, being active, being, you know, all these things, contributing to food security, feeding the world, obviously great. But definitely, I mean, it is just an enormously challenging job. And it's not a job, actually. It's a lifestyle, isn't it? See, I told you were going to set me off.
No. It wasn't a trap. It was just, I just want to know your take on that because of...
Well, you got it. It's a hard industry to commit yourself to. And you got livestock. I mean, you're not traveling the world and taking off whenever you feel like it. And, you know, it's incredibly difficult.
Like an agriculture reporter, for instance.
Exactly.
And
nowhere. With thanks to COVID, but anyway.
Thanks for yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
There was a time, but now.
Back in the glory days.
It's over. And yeah, that's why coming back to agricultural policy, they negotiators in the end agreed on setting a minimum of 3% of national envelopes for direct payments to fund young farmers through this complementary income support. But also through some targeted aid, for instance, for startups, with also a weighting factor of 50%, which is quite good. So in the end, it was ambitious, but not that much. But still, it's an interesting innovation because it's something new. And it's an important decision. And we...
Who better to speak to on this? We spoke to the very newly elected, I think just the other day elected, president of Young Farmers Association, CEJA. So that's Diana Lenzi. And this is what Diana had to say.
CEJA, the European Council of Young Farmers, was happy to acknowledge on Monday, while in the midst of its own electoral process, that after three long and complicated years, an agreement was finally reached on the CAP reform. Young farmers and all farmers have been waiting eagerly and with some concern for the legislators to finalize this reform that will affect and impact their day-to-day work, that will put them on the forefront of the battle of sustainability, introducing new measures and instruments, but also reallocating resources that have been so far necessary to stabilize farmers' income. The incredible body of young farmers I now have the honor to represent is working strenuously every day to build a better, healthier, more sustainable farming sector for the future of Europe. That is why it is so important that legislation and policies work to enable and support us to deliver and succeed. European farming is in critical need for generational renewal, and young farmers want to ensure its safety, its prosperity, rejuvenate it for the benefit of all. Generational renewal can't be considered a mere objective like others, because there is no possibility of achieving EU's ambitions on the fronts of sustainability, economic competitiveness, climate action, and social inclusion without a new generation of determined, resourceful, and skillful farmers. This is why we hope that the higher support granted to young farmers is only the starting point to a greater collaboration. We are happy that co-legislators have agreed to allocate a minimum of 3% of direct payments from the national envelopes for young farmers. This increase will be allocated to funding complementary income support, increased budget for first installation aid, and for investments brought forward by young farmers with a weighing factor of 50%. And all of this is necessary for youth that wants to set up and power up a farm, maybe from scratch or through succession. This important decision constitutes a major step towards providing young farmers with adequate tools to further develop their farming activities while benefiting better living conditions. We cannot begin to imagine a future for the farming sector if we don't ensure a dignified livelihood to young farmers who want to get involved in agriculture. Now it's crucial, and CEJA will be vigilant and close to its members in the process, that every member state will align within their national strategic plan all instruments at their disposal to enable the achievement of the CAP generational renewal objective. The flexibility offered by the new delivery system of the national strategic plans must not undermine the unity of the greater European farming and must instead strive to ensure coherence and consistency. I must also say with some disappointment that CEJA and the European Young Farmers regret that co-legislators did not keep a minimum age limit of 40 years old in the young farmers definition. This could undermine the level playing field across the EU and jeopardize the consistency of the performance model, which is so important if we want to see European farming succeed as one.
So that's all from us this week. And this week, like every week, the Euractiv Agri-Food podcast was produced by Euractiv's Agri-Food news team. That's Gerarda Fortuna and Natasha Foote, with the support of our podcast producer, Evie Chiori. And you can also find this podcast on all major streaming platforms. That's Apple, Amazon, Spotify, and Stitcher.
Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter so you don't miss the latest agriculture news from the EU. I'm Gerarda Fortuna. Thanks for listening and see you next week.